Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by The Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and a Bulwark contributor. And I'm joined by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, professor of strategy emeritus at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, contributing writer to The Atlantic. Elliot, I hope you've now sufficiently atoned for all your sins.
Well, yeah, but I've begun sinning again, so I'm kind of building up a store for next year.
Me too.
As one does. We have loads of things to discuss with our guests, so I think we should probably lunge right into the jackassery of the week. Although I will note that our special session on the Quantico Carnival with the Secretary of Defense, not War, Hegseth, and the President has gotten, 630,000 views on YouTube, which is pretty good. So if you haven't seen it, you should see it.
I think we hit a nerve.
Yeah, I think we did. I think the nominee for Jackassery of the Week is the President putting out on Truth Social or whatever it is, this AI-generated video with Russell Vought as the Grim Reaper. And it's just, I never cease to be amazed at the amount of juvenile behavior one gets from people who are nominally grownups.
Alleged grownups. Yes. Well, my, as if Signalgate, was not bad enough, over the weekend, one of Pete Hegseth's factota was talking to one of Stephen Miller's factota on Signal at a wedding, but visible enough to the people sitting near him. They were able to take screenshots and pass them along to the Minneapolis Star Tribune, in which he was asking for direction from the President to the Secretary of Defense / War in order to deploy the 82nd Airborne into American cities. At least he has enough sense to know that that's probably something he needs top cover for. So there you have it. Pretty grim. We have a very special guest returning to Shield of the Republic for a second time. Elliot, would you like to introduce our guest?
I would be delighted. So this is a good friend of both of ours. He was actually on top of that, there's a connection with our old mentor, Al Bernstein. And it's Professor Barry Strauss, who's now the Corliss Page Dean, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, and Bryce and Edith M. Bomar, Professor in Humanistic Studies Emeritus at Cornell University. So he's spent a long and distinguished career at Cornell. He is a terrific military historian of the ancient world. He's not afraid of military history. He's written about all kinds of things from the Battle of Salamis, the Trojan War, the Spartacus War, a great book on the death of Caesar, another book on the 10 Caesars, and he is particularly a specialist on Roman military history. And we have here his book, Jews versus Rome. And first, welcome, Barry. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you, Elliot and Eric. It's great to be here.
We have a particular connection since we actually were teaching in the same institution in Israel for about 3 weeks together. So it was good to see one another there. Barry, since I've got a feeling that most of our listeners don't know a whole lot about the Jewish revolts against Rome, could you summarize those very briefly and say why they're significant? And, I think I said to you a little bit earlier, it's the ancient world, everybody's revolting pretty much. What was so special about the Jews revolting?
Great questions. So the bulk of my book is about these three revolts within the space of 70 years. The Great Revolt, which is 66 to 70 AD CE, with the most famous postscript in military history, Masada, a few years later, and probably in 74. Then came the Diaspora Revolt. Now, everyone's probably heard of Masada, but almost no one's heard of the Diaspora Revolt, yet immensely important. took place in 116 to 117, and it wipes out the Jewish population of Egypt, which was very large, also of Libya and Cyprus, and puts a real dent in Rome's plan to conquer Iraq, the Parthian Empire at that time, since Rome had to divert manpower to putting down these revolts before manpower it could have used in fighting Parthia. And the third revolt is the Bar Kokhba revolt, named after the leader of the revolt, a messianic figure to some. Bar Kokhba is his nom de guerre. And that took place in from 132 to 136. And that, like the Great Revolt, took place in Judea, ancient Israel.
I mean, were the Jews more difficult than other subjugated people? I mean, you have revolts in Britain, you have revolts in Gaul, you know, certainly Germany, elsewhere. Why should we pay particular attention to this set of revolts?
Okay, so you've asked two questions. Why should we pay attention to them, and what makes the Jews different? So a couple of things make the Jews different. You're absolutely right. There are many revolts against the Roman Empire. As one of my colleagues says, the Romans consider revolts to be the price of doing business. And in a way, it was. What's unusual about the Jewish revolts is several things. First of all, there's so many of them. You know, they keep coming. And there had been earlier revolts, smaller ones, or that one were put down very rapidly. One in the year 4 BCE, one in the year 6 CE, and then a series of figures who could have led revolts who were quickly squelched in between. And there were two more in later centuries. One in the 4th century CE that, thanks to archaeology, we're learning a lot more about now. And then finally, the last one in the 7th century CE when the Persians again invade Judea and there are Jews who join the revolt. And for a brief period, Jerusalem becomes a Jewish-run city again. So there are a lot of these revolts. That's one thing. The second thing about them is that all of the other revolts take place in newly conquered or nearly newly conquered areas. But when the Great Revolt begins, Judea had been under Rome's thumb for 120 years, and it had been an ally of Rome for practically another century before that. So from the Roman point of view, here are these ingrates revolting after we've been good to them for such a long period of time. And the Romans probably did help the Jews win their independence against the Seleucid Empire under the Maccabees in the 2nd century BCE. The other thing that makes them different and worrisome for the Romans is the diaspora. So there's Germans in Germany, and there are Germans who serve in the Imperial Guard, but by and large, there's not a German diaspora for the Romans to worry about. Likewise, the Brits, likewise, the Numidians, likewise, the Dalmatians, the Illyrians, when they revolt, but very substantial Jewish community in Egypt, in Alexandria, which is probably has the largest population of any Jewish city in the world at the time. Substantial Jewish communities in Syria, in Cyprus, in Asia Minor, in Libya, and the city of Rome itself. As if all of that wasn't enough concern for Rome, there's also a big Jewish diaspora in Rome's rival and enemy, Parthia. And there are close relations between the Jews of Judea and the Jews of Parthia. Indeed, the rebels were hoping to get Parthian help, and I believe they did get Parthian help in the diaspora revolt. So all of these things make the revolts a matter of great concern for the Romans. And also, let's not forget that after the Romans conquered Judea in the year 63 BCE, 23 years later, the Parthians come in and conquer Judea away from the Romans. And it takes the Romans 3 years to get Judea back. So, and the Romans are very well aware that the Jews of antiquity and the Iranians, first the Achaemenid Persians and the Parthians and the Sasanians, they have very good relations. And there are many Jews in Judea who would like nothing better than to be a client of Parthia again, rather than a subject of the Roman Empire. So all of these things are pushing the Romans' buttons and making them more concerned about these revolts than they might be otherwise.
Barry, I mean, could you talk a little bit more about that point you just made about sort of the geostrategic nature of this? Because the Judeans are sort of sitting right you know, on the border essentially with the East, which is the you know, major part of the antique world that was not controlled by the Romans. And so it's, you know, kind of extraordinarily sensitive civilizational fault line for the Romans. And talk a little bit about, if you could, about the complexity of the ethnic and religious composition of Judea, which is something you talk about in the book very, very well.
Yeah, thank you. So as I say in the book, I think that when the Romans hear Judea, they think Parthia. They think Judea, Shmudea. We don't care that much about it, but we do care about Parthia, which is our number one rival and enemy. And the Judeans, the Jews, have a history with Parthia, and they're looking towards Parthia all the time. That's one of the things that makes the Romans very nervous about this. I think that's one thing that we need to think of the geostrategy. And there are people in Judea who are very good, who understand this very well, and they know the importance of Rome. They're under the thumb of Rome. They have to have good relations with Rome, but they're also looking over their shoulder at Parthia and thinking, maybe we can get back in touch with the Parthians. Maybe we'd get a better deal from the Parthians. They probably had a better deal from the Persians than they were getting from the Romans. So it makes Judea kind of a swing province for the Romans and something they're concerned about and something that the rebels also are hoping to capitalize on. And perhaps the Parthians as well have it in the back of their minds that someday they might be able to use Judea for their own ends against Rome, as they did briefly in the first century BCE. As far as the ethnic complexity of Judea, it is a very complicated place. So the dominant group are the Jews. Are they the majority? Probably, but we don't know. We do not have good population figures for this region. And our population figures for the Roman Empire in general are a lot weaker than it might seem. But there are other groups there. In most of the cities outside of Jerusalem, there is a large Greek-speaking population. The sources sometimes call them Greeks, sometimes call them Syrians. They're a bit of both. A large number of them are Syrians who are now speaking Greek because the area was conquered by the Macedonians under Alexander the Great and Hellenized for centuries. Some of them are colonists from Greece or from Macedon. Some of them are Canaanites who've eventually become Greek speakers. Second group is Samaritans. These are the people who live in Samaria. They're very interesting. They follow the Torah, as do the Jews in this period, but they do not accept the Jerusalem priesthood. They think that they have their own priesthood. They have their own temple on Mount Gerizim near the modern city of Nablus. And they don't like the Romans, but in some ways they dislike the Jews even more. So they're in the mix as well. And finally, there are also two small Arab communities in the north and in the south. Then there are the Idumeans, kind of interesting people. Originally, they lived in Edom, which is to say in modern Jordan. And centuries earlier, they had migrated into what is now central Israel. They had largely converted to Judaism in the second century when they were conquered by the Maccabees, the Hasmonean dynasty. Nowadays, most scholars think it's a voluntary conversion rather than a forced conversion. but some of them had not given up their pagan gods, who they still keep on the shelf there in the background as well. So very complicated ethnic makeup of the area.
You know, I understand the Parthian part of this, which you describe, but the Parthians never really come to the rescue of any of the Jewish revolts in any major way that we're aware of. I mean, there may have been subsidies or something like that, but there's no Parthian army that comes.
No, there's no Parthian army. They do play a big part in the diaspora revolt.
But I guess here's the thing. I mean, I guess I would have thought that it would be common knowledge that you revolt against the Romans, sooner or later they're going to come get you. And, you know, and they do things to make a point of what's going to happen to you if you continue to revolt. I mean, one way to view the story of Masada, which is, you know, this little isolated fortress, which 4 years after the Great Revolt, the Romans besiege, and one way or another, most, if not all, of the population either commits suicide or gets killed. You know, it's a way of sending a message saying, no, you know, even if you're small and insignificant, we're going to come get you. And that's, you know, certainly the message of the Spartacus revolt and other revolts. What were the Jews thinking? I mean, it's clear there were, you know, particularly among the rabbis, you know, they were not in favor. There were some of the rabbis were not in favor of the Great Revolt. And there are famously rabbis who were deeply opposed to the Bar Kokhba revolt. What were they thinking, or were they thinking?
Well, okay, lots of quite good questions there. Yes, the Romans succeed against every revolt except when they don't. So they don't succeed against the revolt in Germany. The Germans successfully defeat the Romans and win their independence. For a time, they don't succeed against the revolt in Frisia, in the Netherlands. It takes the Romans about a generation before they come back and put that down. They don't succeed in conquering Scotland, Caledonia. The Caledonians successfully get the Romans out. They don't succeed in Mesopotamia, at least not at first. Trajan's attempt to conquer Mesopotamia fails. Nor do they succeed against Sudan. They tried to conquer Sudan, and they're utterly pushed out of Sudan, with the coup de grace being taking a statue of Augustus, cutting the head off, and putting the head under the threshold so that anyone who of a temple, so that anyone enters the temple is going to trample on Augustus. That wonderful head is now in the British Museum. So I guess from the rebels' point of view, it was like, A, yeah, you're right. The Romans usually win, but they don't always win. And B, as you well know, there's an endless human capacity to say this time is different. I do think the Parthian connection and the diaspora connection are important. I do think the role of the dynasty of the ruling dynasty of Adiabene, which is to say ancient Iraqi Kurdistan, is very important. They convert to Judaism. They bury their kings in Jerusalem, of all places. They build palaces in Jerusalem. They send their sons and grandsons to Jerusalem to be educated, just as pro-Roman Jews sent their sons and grandsons to Rome to be educated. And they fight in the Great Revolt on the side of the rebels. So if you want rational reasons why they might support the revolt, it's not completely insane to think that they might do it. And Jerusalem is a very, very, very well-fortified city. If you want irrational reasons, this is the golden age of apocalyptic and messianic thinking in Judaism. You know, so there are lots of people who think the world's going to come to an end. The kingdom of God is at hand. The end of days is coming. There's going to be the redemption. Israel is going to be redeemed. The heathen desecrators of the Holy Land are going to be thrown out. So there are those people as well who have irrational reasons, if you will, for supporting the revolt. As far as the rabbis, yeah, the Talmud tells a great story about how all the rabbis are opposed to the revolt. But the Talmud is written centuries later, as you well know. And there are reasons to think that maybe not all the rabbis were totally opposed to the revolt. We know that Rabbi Akiva supported Bar Kokhba. As far as the revolt, first revolt, yes, Yohanan ben Zakkai does leave Jerusalem. But why was he there? You know, why is he in Jerusalem if he's opposed to the revolt? Some of the people opposed to the revolt left at the word go. So I guess I'd say it's a complicated picture.
You do make the point, Barry, that there were deep divisions among the Jews in Judea about the wisdom of taking on the Roman Empire. And I mean, the main literary source, although not the only one that we have for the Great Revolt, as you describe in detail, is the history of the Jewish War by Josephus, who is Jewish and who both. He participates at least at the outset of the revolt. He's a turncoat who ends up defecting essentially to the Romans, and whose history is meant to show the folly of the Jewish opposition to the Roman Empire. Talk a little bit about the divisions and also about the difficulty as you, as a modern historian, having to rely on Josephus's text, which clearly has many, many axes to grind.
Yeah. So Josephus is a wonderful storyteller and a fascinating person, but obviously a complicated one. It's like having the story of the American Revolution as told by Benedict Arnold, but who also wanted to justify the Americans in the eyes of his British readership. So Josephus, okay, so I'm sorry, Eric, I've lost the track of what you asked.
Benedict Arnold, as Eric Edelman knows, I'm always willing to talk about Benedict Arnold, but yeah. I guess
let's not go there. But the question really was, as a historian, modern historian, how do you deal with the clear bias that Josephus has, and but also the divisions among the Jews
in the day? Okay.
Who were basically the Vichy Jews who were willing to,
to
collaborate with the Romans and those who were opposed?
There's a significant part of the Jewish population that collaborates with the Romans for all sorts of reasons. Some of them might have thought there's no choice. You know, it's folly to revolt against people as powerful as the Romans. Some of them might have thought, gee, we admire the Roman Empire. We think the Roman Empire is kind of cool, and we want to be part of the Roman Empire. And some of them might have had whatever reasons. They might have thought, as Josephus eventually does, clearly God is on the side of the Romans, and this is what we as pious Jews ought to do, understand God's will and follow the Romans that way. Others might have thought, the Romans are awful, but we can ride it out. Let's just ride out the storm, and we'll see what happens. So very complicated, so there's a king, a princeling of northern, what's now a part of the Galilee and the Golan Heights. His name is Agrippa II. His father, Agrippa I, had actually been king of all of Judea briefly for 3 years before he died an untimely death, possibly stroke, possibly poisoned, possibly heart attack, unclear. But so Agrippa II's on the side of Rome, and so is his sister, who is a power player named Berenike. And they are trying to beg the rebels to step back and not do this foolish thing of rebelling against the world's mightiest empire. But they fail. However, they do provide aid and comfort to the Romans. They send troops, or Agrippa II sends troops to help the Romans against the Jewish rebels. He he hosts Vespasian and Titus in his palace, in the Golan, and ultimately Berenike becomes the mistress of Titus, which is in itself quite a story. So there's big divisions in the Jewish world about this. I also mention in the book a man named Tiberius Julius Alexander, who comes from the elite of Egypt, and is probably the nephew of the great philosopher Philo, who rises in the Roman service. And of all things, he is the chief of staff of Titus when Titus lays siege to Jerusalem, a much more experienced soldier, an older man than Titus, and probably, alas, tells Titus how to take the city. So there you go. Really a variety of opinions. Though I have no doubt that the Vichy Jews are the minority in this case, and the majority support the rebels either actively or passively.
And on Josephus, as a modern historian, how did you approach using him? Because as you say, he's very beguiling when you read him.
Yeah, he's a wonderful writer and great storyteller, and we're very lucky to have him, such a detailed source. We don't have any sources like that for any of the other revolts against the Roman Empire. But exactly as you say, he's very problematic, has huge number of axes to grind. So you have to read a lot of scholarship on Josephus and a lot of commentaries on Josephus to get a sense of what axes he has to grind. You have to look at what other sources we have. You know the game with ancient history. It's like squeezing water from a rock. It's very difficult. But there is that water. Tacitus, the great Roman historian, wrote about the Great Revolt. Sadly, we only have about the first 15 to 20 pages of his account. The rest of it has not survived from antiquity. But we do have that. We have inscriptions. We have coins. We learn a lot from the coins about these revolts. And we have archaeological evidence. In one case, for instance, the city of Jotapata. This is a small city in the Galilee. And it is there that Josephus has his moment of glory. He leads the defense of the city against Vespasian and the Romans for 6 or 7 weeks in the summer of 67. Ultimately, the Romans take the city. But he gives us some numbers for casualties, for instance, and like many of his numbers, they're exaggerated. The city has been excavated by Israeli archaeologists in the 1990s, and they tell us some things. I mean, they tell us that basically the account of what happened in the siege is credible. The archaeological evidence does indicate a city that's destroyed in a siege at this time. They tell us that the numbers that Josephus gives for the casualties are way, way, way exaggerated, as we might have guessed. They also have some very interesting vignettes about what happened to the people at the end of the siege, how the siege is commemorated by the survivors, what happens to the town. So you have to bring all this evidence. We have some papyrus, papyrological evidence, mostly of the Bar Kokhba revolt, but some of the Great Revolt as well. You got to bring all this in. And also, when you get to be as old as I am and you've done a lot of ancient history, you have some knowledge of what works in the ancient world and what doesn't. And when someone says something that just seems like a whopper, you've been there before, like how fast boats can go, for instance, how many carts you can get on a certain road, you can say, wait a minute, you know, that's just not credible. So you got to pull all those things in.
So I'm going to want to go back to that in a moment later on when we kind of broaden out. But I did want to ask you a follow-up question, which is that, you know, one of the things that strikes me is reading sort of the whole narrative is that what you, as hard as the Romans are on the Jews, particularly after the Bar Kokhba revolt. And, you know, the Talmud, as you know, refers to Hadrian as Hadrian the Evil. And, you know, he really de-Judaizes Jerusalem in a very thorough way. That the Romans, and it's clear that, just what I recall from Tacitus, they really didn't like the Jews, and they thought that their religion is really weird and kind of sick and strange. That what you don't see is an eliminationist strand of anti-Semitism. I mean, there's plenty of massacre and murder and, you know, all the horrors of
enslavement,
gladiators, the whole business. But you don't see the eliminationist streak. And the Romans were capable of that. It's, after all, what they did to the Carthaginians. But why not?
Well, that's an excellent question. And I guess I would say a couple of reasons. For one thing, I guess I think the Romans had more complicated attitude towards the Jews. Certainly that you get people like Cicero and Tacitus sneering at the Jews. But there are not a few number of Romans who become so-called God-fearers. That is to say, they hang around synagogues. And they're really interested in Judaism. They don't convert to Judaism, whatever conversion means in this period, which is another complicated question. But they're hangers-on. And there are a lot of Romans who admire the Jews as an ancient religion, an ancient people. From the Roman point of view, old is good. They're not entirely willing to get rid of the Jews. They also think the Jews can still be useful. After all, the Romans are going to be a presence in the Near East. There are a lot of Jews around, and the Romans can still use them now that they've made their point. As far as the Carthaginians, I once floated the idea, which nobody really accepted, that the Romans didn't go in for genocide so much as civitaticide. They didn't insist on eliminating all the Carthaginians. In fact, the original offer they gave to the Carthaginians is, leave your city, let us destroy it, and you can live a rural life. We don't mind. And after the destruction of Carthage, there's still lots of Punic speakers in North Africa. The Romans don't go around wanting to kill every last one of them. Also, it's very difficult to commit genocide without modern technology. I mean, you have to go and kill every person individually or throw them off a cliff or into the sea. It's very grim work. And even the Romans, aren't into that. So I don't know. I hope that answers your question.
Can I take it? I want to go back to the to Eric's question about Josephus and ask you to broaden it out now, talking about Roman history in general. So, you know, we have these wonderful classical historians, Josephus and Tacitus and Polybius and the rest, who've given us the basic narrative. And, you know, it's the stuff which, say, somebody like Gibbon wrote, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. But now we have the archaeology. We have the, you mentioned the studying coins for evidence. Maybe you can talk more about that. And I guess my kind of overall naive question is, to what extent do the modern sciences, I guess you can call them, of archaeology and numismatics, the study of the coins, really change our understanding of the ancient world? Or they just add kind of color and detail to the basic narrative thrust of the great ancient historians insofar as we have them?
Yeah, I think, it's really a great question. And in a way, we're talking about apples and oranges. I mean, one of the reasons that we esteem the ancient historians is because of the power of their narrative, the power of their rhetoric, and their influence on Western civilization. I mean, if we want to study the Western heritage, we read these guys. They're part of what we need to do. And in the case of Sappho, these women as well. If your goal is to do ancient history and to see ancient society via eigentlich gewesen as it really was, then it's a different game. And the evidence of material culture, as we call it nowadays, is absolutely essential. You can't really do ancient history and just read the literary sources. You need this other evidence to tell you what things were really like. And we now have so much of it, and our study of it is so sophisticated that it really changes a lot of ancient society. So the coins, for instance, tell us a lot about the propaganda or what people thought about in a way that the ancient historians might not. So Josephus does tell us that freedom is very important to the rebels, but we see it on the coins where they talk about for the freedom of Jerusalem or for the freedom of Zion. And we see in the coins that they also talk about the redemption, which is very important for them. And it's a reminder that this apocalyptic vision is very much part of their program. They number their coins from the years of the revolt, just like the French Revolution. So the first year is year one, et cetera. And then, to me, one of the most amazing things about the coins is they're not written in Aramaic and they're not written in contemporary Hebrew. They're written in Paleo Hebrew, in an archaic form of Hebrew. They're consciously archaizing and going back to an earlier time, which also tells us something about their goals, the goals of the revolt. So that would be a small example of the kind of thing we get from the archaeological evidence. We get some sense of life expectancy in antiquity. We know a lot about the ancient diet, about the diseases that people had from the archaeological evidence. We've reconstructed cities. I mean, think of all the stuff we get from Pompeii and Herculaneum and the other places around Vesuvius. Those are exceptionally well-documented places, but there are others in the ancient world. So we learn a lot from the archaeological evidence. And in places where we don't have good archaeology, relatively speaking, like Alexandria, Egypt, we're really sad that, you know, we can't do a better job of recreating it.
Of course, in the case of your book, I mean, in Israel, archaeology is like a national pastime, yes. Sort of like baseball, yeah, in the United States. I mean, everybody is, you know, what was it that Carl Becker said? Every man his own historian. And in Israel, I used to think it was like every man and woman their own archaeologist.
So true.
And in particular, in for your subject, you talk about the role of Yigal Yadin, you know, a former Israeli general officer, also politician, political leader, yeah, but archaeologist who did massive work in the early 60s at Masada. I mean, a lot of what, yeah, we think we know comes from that, although, as you suggest, some of that story seems to have changed with more recent archaeological work. Could you talk about that a bit?
Sure. So you're absolutely right. Archaeology is a national pastime in Israel, and archaeology has illuminated the Jewish past, sometimes the Gentile past as well, but mostly the Jewish past in fascinating ways. The Israelis clearly want to show that there's an ancient Jewish presence in the land, and they've done that totally convincingly. In the case of Masada, so Yadin did excavate it in the 1960s, and I think that most archaeologists think it was a very good excavation, but there's some of his conclusions are not accepted anymore. And this happens all the time in archaeology. You know, you think that archaeological evidence is objective, but it's not entirely objective. It needs to be interpreted, and we need to understand what it means. So Yadin thought that he had found the tokens of Yadin thought he found the bones of some of the rebels from Masada, but I think it's been restudied, and we think they're probably Roman soldiers or later people there, not so much. Yadin thought that he had found the tokens that the rebels used before they decided who was going to kill who in the mass execution and suicide. I think that's highly questioned as to whether he found that or not. The Roman camps, which are just so visible and impressive at the foot of Masada, they've been excavated since Yadin. The ramp there's been revisionism and then revision of the revisionism about the ramp. Originally, it was thought that they found the Roman ramp. Then there are new archaeologists who said, no, the ramp was never completed. But then a third group looked at it and said, yes, the ramp really was completed. But one thing that becomes clear is that although Josephus wants to make it sound as if building this ramp was just an extraordinary architectural engineering achievement, actually, it wasn't that big a deal. It wasn't that hard for the Romans to do. And I think on The Sopranos, the Jewish guy who's telling Tony about the as you know, I have to bring in the mafia. But okay, the Jewish guy who's telling Tony, and you know why too. The Jewish guy who's telling Tony about Masada says the rebels at Masada held out for 2 years. Maybe a month or two is what we now think is more likely. Partly because the Romans could never have stayed there for 2 years because it would have been impossible to supply themselves with food and water in the desert. The folks on Masada had food that had been laid up there for a very long time by Herod. And they also had a water supply. But the folks down the base of Masada didn't have that. So we now think it's more likely that 6 weeks maybe for the whole thing.
But, you know, one thing that is striking, though, I think about Masada, and particularly about Yadin, is the role that archaeology played in the sort of the Israeli construction of the Israeli myth. And I don't mean by myth falsehood, but, you know, you said the slogan, Masada will not fall again. I think one of the core, maybe the armored core of the Israel Defense Forces, they get commissioned up at Masada with the sort of a torchlight parade. You know, the Zionist revisionists under Jabotinsky was the Beitar movement after where Bar Kokhba, there's a similar sort of, at least the legend of a mass suicide rather than surrender to Rome. So the symbols are really remain very powerful. And I think this is probably true of archaeology in general, that you know, that it ends up tapping into some very deeply held kind of national beliefs and sensibilities.
Yeah, I mean, in the late 19th century, there was almost an archaeological arms race among Britain, France, Germany, and to a lesser extent, the United States. And the Kaiser was absolutely concerned that Germany not fall behind. Now, in the 1870s, Schliemann, who was a very shady character, if a pioneer, started excavating Troy. And German academia rightly questioned him and said, who is this guy and how can we trust him anything? The Kaiser loved him. The Kaiser, you know, kind of brought Schliemann back. And said, this is a great moment for Germany. Also, Germany's ambitions were to be in alliance with the Ottoman Empire. And it's not an accident that he thought it was so important to have this Troy being a German excavation in the Ottoman Empire. Interestingly, in the 1990s, when Troy was re-excavated by a joint German-American team. The Americans did the later stuff. The Germans did the Bronze Age stuff, so the good stuff from Homer and the Trojan War. The excavator, chief excavator, very interesting guy who is a German who then got dual citizenship in Turkey, where he did most of his excavations. He wanted us to see Troy as a bridge between East and West, not as a symbol of Western civilization. He's definitely looking at the role of Turkish immigrants to Germany and trying to defend them within German society. So, as you say, archaeology is very political wherever you go and in every country, and Israel is no exception.
Yeah. Can we broaden things out a little bit more even? So when you and I were in Israel together, you know, we had a talk, of course, about contemporary politics and the state of our society. You have interesting things to say about the university world, which I hope we can get to. But,
sure.
But we ended up having a conversation about decadence. And and you had you offered the wisdom of a historian of Rome. I was wondering if you could do that for our listeners. Maybe we could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. At the risk of being simplistic, and I will definitely be simplistic. The ancients explained the ancients believed in the rise and fall of civilizations, the rise and fall of empires, rise and fall of society, and they thought that one of the things, the main driver of the fall, is decadence. It's just that when, and actually the person who I think says this best is Ibn Khaldun, the Arab historian of the Middle Ages. He talks about how group solidarity, I'll butcher the Arabic, but I think it's a sabia, leads to hard, rough people from the desert banding together and conquering cities, conquering wealthier places. And these wealthier places are open to conquest because they have squandered their patrimony. Over the generations, they become soft and easygoing, and they are easy pickings for the hard men from the desert. But then those hard men from the desert get soft in turn, and they are easy pickings for someone else. The Greeks and Romans talked about this. The Greeks call it truthe, the idea that luxury is dangerous. It corrupts people. It's a big theme in Herodotus. And if you want to stay free, you've got to stay hard. Otherwise, your freedom is going to, you're going to lose your freedom because you don't have that edge anymore. So, you know, if you want my simplistic explanation of what's happened to the West is luxury, truffe. We've lost our edge. We've got very soft. And that's a problem.
Of course, Gibbon had another explanation for the decline of the Roman Empire, which was Christianity, the rise of Christianity. And to go back to your book, I wonder, you know, you did a great job just earlier talking about the God-fearers, the people who were Judaism adjacent, you might say.
Right, Judaism adjacent, yes.
But you also make the point that the crushing of the Great Revolt actually may have had a very big impact on the spread of Christianity, in the sense that the Christian communities were sort of divided at this point between those who wanted who thought that the way to be a follower of Jesus was to convert people to Judaism, and they thought of themselves still as a Jewish community, and that Christ happened to be the Messiah that everybody else had been waiting for or continued to wait for. And the Pauline dispensation, which was, no, we've got to go to the Gentiles and convert all the Gentiles, and we are separate from Judaism. Can you talk a little bit about how what happened in 70 AD kind of made an impact there?
It's absolutely true that the Great Revolt and the Bar Kokhba Revolt increase the parting of the ways, as scholar calls it. Scholars call it the parting of ways between Judaism and Christianity. It becomes harder to say we're Jews and you ought to accept Jesus after the Great Revolt, because the Jews are now bad guys in the Roman Empire. They stab the Romans in the back. They're pro-Parthian. They're ingrates who revolted. It becomes easier to separate oneself from the Jews. you know, there's one tradition, I think in Eusebius, though, maybe a different source, that the Christians were warned from above to leave Jerusalem on the beginning of the revolt, and they went to a city that's now in Jordan to get refuge. During the Bar Kokhba revolt, Bar Kokhba's followers ask people to recognize Bar Kokhba as the Messiah, and Christians say, "I'm terribly sorry, we already have a Messiah." Some of them are punished, executed by the rebels. Some of them just run away from the rebels. So it's not a good scene. The Jerusalem church can't really exist anymore when Jerusalem doesn't exist as a Jewish city. There's still Christians in Judea. And it's important to point out that scholars nowadays wouldn't use the word Christian for what we have in the first century. They would say followers of Jesus, Christ followers, because their relationship to Judaism was not set in stone. It just wasn't clear what was going to happen. And as far as St. Paul, on the one hand, yes, he is devoted to a mission to the Gentiles. But on the other hand, he hasn't given up being Jewish. So it's complicated. And even later on, in the later Roman Empire, it's clear there are still Christians who follow the Jewish calendar, who go to synagogues, who mingle with Jews. I mean, where does one begin and where does the other end? It's just not such a clear thing. But without question, these revolts make it more difficult to say the way to follow Jesus is to become a Jew.
You know, one of the things that I've always found fascinating is, okay, even after the Bar Kokhba revolt, Palestine is not Judenrein at all.
No, it's not.
In fact, you have this very lively community in the Galilee.
Yes.
You know, we've both been to Zippori, which was the original Sepphoris, I guess.
Yes.
Which, you know, has been excavated. It's an incredible excavation. I think anybody
it really is
goes to Israel and see that. You have the codification of the kind of the first cut at the oral law, I guess, around the early 3rd century. And you know, the Jews survive this, and they take, you know, what had already become in some ways a portable religion, make it more so. There is one last crack at rebuilding the temple. So the second temple is destroyed famously by the Romans. You have a wonderful account of that. There are different issues. You know, was Titus actually in favor of burning the temple down or not? But there's one more crack, and he's a historical figure I've always been fascinated by, and I don't know nearly enough about, and that's Julian the Apostate. Who did apparently, I guess, sort of authorize the Jews to rebuild the temple, which in retrospect probably would not have been a good idea. But he dies young, and so it doesn't. Could you just, this is just idle curiosity, tell me more about Julian the Apostate.
Sure. So archaeology does tell us, by the way, in answer to your earlier question, that Jews still wanted to rebuild the temple. We have tombstones centuries later that date. The date comes from the destruction of the temple. So this is still on the agenda. Julian's a really interesting guy. He is part of the imperial family and raised as a Christian, but also has, as many did, a pagan education in the classics. And he decides, actually, he wants to be a pagan. And he's opposed to Christianity. So he wants to turn the clock back, if you'll forgive the anachronism, turn the water glass back or whatever. And one of the things he wants to do is to rebuild the temple. And he does it less because he wants to be nice to the Jews than because he wants to stick it to the Christians and to say, you know what? You know, the temple, Jesus, you know, prophesied that the temple would be destroyed. And some Christians say that the destruction of the temple proves the truth of Jesus' prophecies. So Julian wants to say, no, we're going to rebuild the temple. So much for that. But he dies young in yet another attempt to conquer the Parthian Empire, another attempt to conquer Iraq. He may have been killed by friendly fire. It's unclear. There are some who think he was killed by a Christian soldier who realized how dangerous Julian was, because after him, there are no other more pagan emperors. So the attempt to rebuild the temple comes to naught.
We're running short on time, so let me ask my last question, then hand it over to Eric. So we were both in Israel together, and of course, you know, it's very hard to, you know, to read this book, and you know, which is an account of a lot of devastation, particularly of, not in the diaspora too, but particularly there. And you see this, you know, this flourishing, if troubled, Jewish state. Of course, there's a lot of symbolism. We were talking in the green room in November 1947, after the UN resolution on the partition of what was then Palestine and the creation of Israel, a group of displaced persons marched backwards through the Arch of Titus in Rome. And I confess that there's a little part of me which, whenever I go to Rome and I see the Arch of Titus, I go, screw you, we're still around. which is, you know, I think in some ways a typical Jewish reaction.
Yeah, I think so.
I'm just curious if you had any reflections. You know, this book was just coming out as you were teaching there, as I was. Did you have any particular thoughts that crossed your mind while doing that, and while you were able to travel around a little bit more than I was, you know, as you saw what Israel is like today?
Yeah, I mean, great question. It was hard for me not to have constant shivers down my spine as I thought of the ways that history is repeating itself. God forbid it has the same end that it did in antiquity. But then as now, Israel has to pay attention, is in a very complicated region, and has to pay attention to neighbors to the east and to the west, as far west, of course, as the United States. Also, Israel was famously divided. The Jews were immensely divided during the Great Revolt. And alas, there are a lot of divisions within Israel now. Fortunately, not as serious as those divisions in the Great Revolt, but significant nonetheless. And I think it's really interesting that many Israeli commentators, you know, even before October 7th, when there was the controversy over the judicial reforms, were saying, yeah, let's disagree, but let's also remember there's a limit. And our history shows how untrammeled dissent can be self-destructive. And ever since October 7th, even more so, many references to Masada, many references to Jewish history. So I think that people in Israel are very, very aware of this history, and they refer to it in ways that Americans refer to the revolution or the civil war, or maybe I should say that Americans used to refer to the revolution and the civil war.
They knew some things about the revolution and the civil war.
Yeah, exactly. They should read your books, Elliot.
Barry, it's been great to have you. I want to make sure our viewers and listeners know, not only can they buy your book, and we'll have a link to it in the show notes.
Thank you.
But having also not just read your books, but heard you lecture, I can tell them that if they have the opportunity to hear you lecture, that they're really in for a treat, and they should definitely take advantage of the opportunity. And it prompts a question, which is, what is your next book going to be?
I could tell you, but I'd have to kill you. No. I have two ideas for books, and we'll see which way I go. One is about history of military deception, and the other is a book about leadership that I had the privilege to discuss with Elliot, sitting in a cafe in Jerusalem on a beautiful sunny day, and kind of leadership in crisis in the ancient world. So one or maybe both, who knows, of those two books will be my next book.
Well, once you've made up your mind and gotten it between two covers, we will definitely have you back, if not before. But
you're very kind. Thank you.
So thanks so much for joining us on Shield of the Republic. It's been really a pleasure.
Thanks, Barry.
Thank you, guys. The pleasure was mine.